U.S. ETFs rewrote the record books once again in 2025. Assets climbed to new heights, launches accelerated, and investor behavior shifted in material ways. In today's episode of FactSet Insight Podcast, we draw on our annual ETF market analysis to discuss what the full year data reveals about the ETF market. Welcome to our listeners. I'm Lois Gregson, Senior ETF Analyst at FactSet. Joining me is Elizabeth Kashner, Vice President, Director of Global Fund Analytics at FactSet. Elizabeth, welcome.
Lois, thank you for the kind introduction. I'm really excited to chat with you today.
Great. So Elizabeth, on your blog at insight.factset.com, you titled your annual analysis, ETF Investors Identity Crisis. Give our listeners the highlights of that sentiment before we dive into more of the details.
Sure. So what it comes down to is that in another record-breaking year, both for asset growth and ETF flows, you can tell different stories depending on which statistic you want to look at. If you just want to look at dollar amount, what kinds of ETFs gathered the most assets, then the answer continues to be the broad-based, cap-weighted, very vanilla core building block funds like S&P 500 or Vanguard Total Market that have dominated the charts for years and are also at the top of the asset level. But if you take a look from a market share perspective, what we saw was a significant gain for actively managed ETFs. And of course, when one area gains, other areas on a percentage basis look smaller.
Interesting. All right. So yeah, definitely a lot here to dive into then on those. So let's kind of give this a look. So given the historical dominance of passive vanilla products in the ETF space, what would you say are the key factors in behind this growing popularity and the rapid asset growth of the actively managed ETFs?
Well, I would say there's two phenomena at play, but they're linked. So back in 2020, we had the advent of what the insiders call 6c11, and everybody else calls the ETF rule. I think technically it came on board in December of 2019.
Right.
And it made it much, much easier to launch an ETF, standardized a lot of the rules. And then a year or two later, active ETFs got permission to use custom creation redemption baskets, which had previously been out of reach. And those two regulatory changes together really made it much more possible and attractive for traditional asset managers to launch ETF products. So that's on the regulatory side, but then on the consumer preference side, mutual funds as a wrapper just can't catch a break. They've been losing assets for at least a decade. And much of the money that's coming out specifically of actively managed mutual funds is now going into actively managed ETFs. And it's not one for one. Some of those dollars do appear to be going into passive products. So overall, you can see the footprint of active shrinking. But you know what we're seeing on the ETF side is a real upswell of assets coming in for active products.
Well, that's, looking at some of the data, though, you noted that the increase in the number of launches also set a record last year in 2025. So the number of launches there, and just looking at those, like 80% of the launches in 2025 in the ETF space were actively managed. So and clearly, a lot has grown in the active space or in the active ETF space. So appreciate that. But again, with this increase in actively managed funds, how has it impacted your investor behavior?
You know, I think it really depends on which investors you're talking about and on sort of how tightly you want to focus your microscope when you're looking at the data. You know, for years, the story was super clear that ETF investors of all stripes, all asset classes, all strategies were marching in lockstep towards the cheapest products. And you could demonstrate that, you know, very simply. It was a very straightforward chart, didn't need a lot of interpretation. But in the past 2 years, the headline numbers have gotten more confusing because the overall asset-weighted expense ratio has actually increased in the US ETF industry. And so you look at that, and the first thing you might say to yourself is, oh, okay, the fee war is over, people are willing to pay up, it's a seller's market, great. But that would really sort of miss the mark, because once you get down to the details and you start looking really kind of cell by cell at funds that directly compete with each other, that cost consciousness shows up nearly every time. So the sort of famous Boglehead model of I'm going to get beta and I'm going to get it at the cheapest price possible, I'm going to control what I can control from an investor point of view, I think that is very much alive and well. Although, you know, with these new flows into active, a lot of investors are willing to pay a premium for active management over passive management. So it's a little bit more confusing. But like, for example, if you look at, in the option income space, which has really been quite popular past couple of years, it kind of looks like the darling fund, JEPI, a JP Morgan product, and its sibling JEPQ, one based on the S&P 500 and the other on the NASDAQ 100. It looks as if it's been sort of, JEPI has been cast aside for new market share going to funds by the issuer Neos that have similar exposure. And what the people at Neos figured out how to do was to use tax treatment and tax law to their advantage and create a product that in many ways is very similar to JEPI, but has a much more favorable tax profile. And Neos is charging up for that. Like, I think that expense ratio is something like 69 basis points compared to 35 for JEPI. You know, at first glance, you would say, like, well, why would somebody pay nearly double for such a similar product? Setting aside the granular differences between the two and how the portfolios are managed. Like, you know, only an insane person would do that. Well, it's not insane if it saves you more in taxes than you're paying in fees.
True. That and just management. I mean, you're right. Everybody wanted to be in JEPI's or crack that code as to how their success, quickly attracted investors. So it is interesting to see that this kind of change, is noted and that you can provide a certain advantage for that. So it is interesting to watch.
Yeah.
Figuring a way out or a way in, I should say, figuring a way in to crack that market. So,
good. Yeah, incumbents are vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. In addition, I guess it's relative to, you know, other things you're using. Maybe someone was trying to use a more active option strategy themselves and realize how complicated or how challenging it is to do that on your own and how more convenient it is within the wrapper. So congrats to Neos for doing that. So. Interesting. Looking back at your analysis, it revealed that despite, you know, some of the attention around some of the flashier high fee ETFs, the largest flows, though, looking at flows, still go to the cheap, plain vanilla funds. So why do you think there's such a disconnect between what we see here in the industry as chatter and the actual investors putting their dollars to work?
You know, Lois, everybody has a business interest in this space, and the media is no different, right? Media needs to keep their readers engaged and continue to sell their services. The story that, you know, broad-based cheap beta continues to attract money this year and last year and the year before and the year before that, the year before that, it's just not a great headline, you know? The funds themselves are, I would say, beautifully boring, right? They're designed to be stable and reflective of the overall market. And by design, they don't change very much. There's no star portfolio manager who's out there grabbing the mic. Essentially, these cheap beta products are grabbing the dollars and not grabbing the mic.
But it is good to hear. I guess the story is interesting to see. We've heard that before in other areas of the market. It's like I think with crypto, you would say that a lot of people said, "Oh yeah, I'm looking to invest in crypto," and maybe they did, but the flows, more institutional investors getting into that space, and the average advisor or a client still kind of hesitant or curious about the space, interested in the headlines, but maybe don't want to put the dollars in at that space. So interesting to see, we're kind of seeing the dollars going into that plain vanilla approach. So interesting. I did find the same thing also looking at the Canadian ETF industry, just by the way, as a side comment here. We do have a copy of a review of the Canadian ETF market also available at insight.factset.com. The industry or chatter in the industry would have said, everybody's going into the metals, the gold, silver, copper trade. But that's not what we saw in the flows. The flows that we saw in the Canadian ETF market were the plain vanilla, broad-based equity type products. So they continued to keep their market share and percentage of the flows in that space. So if you're interested in what's happening in Canada, you might want to take a look at that blog as well. So that information is there. But let's again take a look at some of the competition. That's always kind of interesting to see. We looked at some of the products and some of the details here. But how do you foresee the competition evolving between the major ETF providers, such as BlackRock and Vanguard, for example?
I feel like the Vanguard BlackRock horse race is a really interesting story right now. Depending on how things go, I think it's possible 2026 could be the year that Vanguard captures the number one spot in terms of ETF assets. But it's far from assured that that would happen. But we did see, on a market share basis, BlackRock really underperformed in 2025. They did not capture the same percentage of the flows that you would expect based on their starting market share. Whereas Vanguard pretty much held steady, and then we saw the newer sort of more active management oriented firms took up a lot of that slack in terms of the issuer space. So like CapGroup, JP Morgan, they are gaining market share.
Interesting.
And so it sort of remains to be seen whether Vanguard dominates by sort of virtue of being the last man standing or by virtue of actually gaining in market share. But I guess I would also say that, the bulk of BlackRock assets are in cheap beta core products, and BlackRock, like Vanguard, like Schwab, offers an excellent product suite of solid funds, well-managed, highly liquid, easy to understand. But in many cases, the BlackRock funds are simply more expensive than their competitors. And in a sort of commoditized market where every basis point counts, I think Vanguard is not always competitive in terms of fees. Sometimes they really are. I think VOO, IVV, that's a neck and neck at 3 basis points. But when you look at some of the Russell 1000, 2000 core growth value suites, like there's a pretty significant pricing discrepancy. So investors are satisfied enough with the liquidity that the BlackRock products provide that that's no longer a differentiator. BlackRock certainly has a higher profitability based on their asset weighted expense ratio and also based on the way that they're directing model portfolio flows into higher cost products. But the cost of that profitability may be in the AUM rankings table.
That'd be interesting to watch. Like I said, BlackRock kind of being on the leaderboard at the top there, what, 25 years roughly. So it'd be interesting to see if Vanguard is able to take that spot. So yeah, always interesting to see those shuffles or what may come up as a part of it. I can't let you go though without talking about specifically fees overall. You've always kept tabs on fees, historically tracking that race to the bottom, as you mentioned earlier. But with the increasing number of ETFs that are available just as a whole, what impact has that had on fees?
So the more ETFs that are out there, yeah, the more competitive the marketplace is, and frankly, the more confusing the marketplace is.
Right.
That's a part of the service that FactSet provides to our clients, is helping to use our classifications and our screening tools to cut through the noise and quickly find a fund that might be interesting to you. The more funds out there, the more valuable that interpretive information becomes. Also just on the competition front, you have to look at the market in terms of like little segments and a pairing of a market segment and a strategy. So, you know, with hundreds of contenders in the US large cap space, they're not all vying against each other. Very small subgroups are. That said, you know, the JPMorgan story, I think, is really, really telling. Like, JPMorgan found a winning formula, mm-hmm, with, you know, volatility control, US large cap, writing options against it. But the market isn't asleep, and the barriers to entry in this field are pretty low, especially, we talked about before, with the ETF rule making it so much easier than it used to be to launch, right, an ETF. Mm-hmm. So it used to be that the first mover advantage was pretty solid, and when you had a good idea, you could, as an asset manager, you know, count on capturing that market, capturing mind share. People would get most comfortable with that product and you had a solid lead. But that first mover advantage doesn't last forever. And when a good idea is out there, it's easy enough to copy it. And the AUM flows to the most efficient products, first mover or not.
It's interesting to see. It's like, it's always so exciting to catch up with you. It's again, keeping up with the ETF industry, that's what I like best about it. There's always something happening and something being reflected there. It is truly a way that I think investors express their opinion in the markets. So fascinating to catch up with you. But with that, Elizabeth, we will wrap up this episode. Thank you all for your insights and for sharing your perspectives. To our listeners, thank you for joining us. And you can find all of our episodes by searching FactSet Insight on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thank you.
Thank you, Lois. Such a pleasure.
The FactSet Insight podcast is for informational purposes only. The information contained within is not legal, tax, or investment advice. FactSet does not endorse or recommend any investments and assumes no liability for any consequence relating directly or indirectly to any action or inaction taken based on the information contained in this podcast episode. The views shared by third-party contributors do not necessarily reflect the opinion of FactSet.